Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. And today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Jay Levy. He is the author of Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways, From Words to Housing. And today we're going to be talking about things like NIST's SDF pre-treatment and the current services that are available. But most importantly, we're going to get a little deeper understanding of what homelessness really means and the issues that those individuals face. It really seems like our society has so many misconceptions surrounding this topic, so we're really, really excited to have Jay talk to us. But first, a little bit about Jay. J.S. Levy has been working with people who are homeless in a variety of roles and settings for more than 20 years. He's a graduate of Columbia University, receiving his MSW degree in 1987. He has provided clinical and outreach services to homeless people living in New York City and Boston. The settings for these clinical services include the shelters, streets, woods, as well as mental health clinics, field programs, drop-in centers, and residential programs. In addition, Jay has published 3 journal articles and a book on pre-treatment methods inclusive of outreach and engagement practices with chronically homeless individuals. Currently, Jay is the Western Regional Manager for Elliott CHS Homeless Services and is one of the architects of the REACH Housing First program that serves chronically homeless individuals. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Irene.
I'm glad to have you online. This is a topic that I'm really interested in, so I'm glad that we can have this discussion. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners are also interested in it. Homelessness seems to be sort of prevalent in our society in the United States.
Yes, it's something I've worked with and done for many years, about 25 years now. It's a subject that's close and dear to my heart.
Well, I'm sure that you certainly have a passion for it, being that you've been working in that industry for so long and, of course, written this book, Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways, From Words to Housing. It certainly gives us an eye-opener. But before we go any further, for our listening audience, and just so that we have some direction, would you define a homeless person? What is a homeless person?
That's an interesting question in itself, because there's many definitions of that. And if you go by the official federal guidelines, the HUD definition of homelessness is someone who's either living in a shelter or living in an unsheltered situation that's not meant for a human habitation. And that would include whether one is living, you know, outside or in a tent or even in a vehicle. What it does not include is things like people who are in poverty and doubled up, you know, maybe living with a friend or a relative. Although many other people, and particularly homeless advocates across the country, would say that those large numbers of people should be counted as well if they can't afford housing of their own.
Your book particularly fits into what category then?
My book is really talking about, it's very focused on this, it's working with the long-term homeless folks that are out there. So it's people that have been sometimes not housed, people without homes for many years. And a number of the illustrations or cases that I work with, the people I work with throughout the book, have been literally either living on the streets or in the woods or, you know, at the Port Authority in New York City. I've been fortunate to have done the work out in New York City as well as Boston and in Western Massachusetts, where I actually got to do some outreach along the riverside and meet up with some pretty hardcore folks that were living out there.
With the people that you work with, why are most of them homeless? What really got them to that place?
Well, everybody has their own story and set of reasons of what leads to it. You know, economic issues, poverty, lack of access to affordable housing always seems to play a part. But beyond that, and with the long-term homeless population that I really specialize in, there's people out there with a whole array of clinical issues, medical issues, addiction, mental health issues, brain injury, so on and so forth. And so all of that, you know, impacts a person's functioning over time. And another big issue that you see sometimes from early childhood onward is trauma being, you know, integrated into what you find when you get to know someone, and whether it's layered trauma through many years or someone who maybe had some of these other issues like, let's say, the addiction issue, just the process of becoming homeless, one is in some level traumatized. So that's always a layer that needs to be worked with as well. So you have people out there with significant issues, and many of the folks really don't have the level of insight or access needed to the services, the support services that would be helpful toward getting someone housed. Another layer of it is that people over time have to find a way to adapt to their situations. And part of that adaptation sometimes for people who are homeless long-term is a kind of acceptance of the situation and a lack of hope of really thinking anything can be changed for the better. And sometimes the folks we meet have learned to connect to some significant meaning that they find in the kind of world and place that they're living. And so, you know, the options we might offer may not provide them with the same kind of meaningful choice and change that they'd be open to at that moment in time.
You had mentioned that some of them, let's say, for example, had a brain injury or, you know, some type of an addiction. So did these people sort of fall through the cracks then, let's say, if it's a medical issue?
Well, yeah, if you can, another way to look at it is there's a lot of hospitals that discharge into homelessness. There's a lack of a safety net. There's a lack of support services and resources that are put toward people that are already impoverished. So it's usually something that occurs over time where a person maybe doesn't have the same kind of family supports they once had. And the system in other ways has not been able to provide the needed support and services, whether it be mental health, you know, through a department of mental health, or someone with a developmental delay, it might be mental retardation or a brain injury kind of service. You know, sometimes there's a drastic accident that leads to all sorts of changes. And, you know, if there's a car accident that causes a brain injury, for instance.
You know, I'm just like, there's something wrong with our system that lets these people go out on the street before they're fully healed, or maybe in some cases, let's say for a brain injury, they may not be able to really function out in society, but yet they're released into society.
Yeah, it's pretty outlandish, and these folks are very vulnerable. Their lives are literally at risk, so I think it's quite an ethical issue. Another place where you see people coming into homelessness is from the foster care system. So think of people who really have not had, you know, very good supports throughout their lives, throughout their childhood, and then they age out of foster care. And as young adults, they're living in the shelters. Many of them end up on the streets.
Really? I had no idea. That's sad. That is sad, not only the trauma of this child not having parents, and quite often put into foster home, more than one foster home, obviously, shifted around from place to place, and then all of a sudden, as you say, they're out of the system because they're too old, and they have no place to go.
Yeah, no, that's correct. And a third place where you see a lot of discharges into homelessness is from our legal system, you know, from the jails. People who for one reason or another have ended up there, some for serious crime, others for maybe not such serious things, but they're in jail, and there's no discharge plan from there, no place for a number of these people to go, and they end up in the shelters on the streets. So you really have quite a mix. Of course, I'm focusing on individual homelessness as we have this conversation, as opposed to families, which is a whole nother array of issues where families and children are impacted.
So is this, I was under the impression that a lot of the homeless people are also Vietnam vets that are suffering from post-traumatic
stress disorder.
Right. Thank you. and ended up on the street because they were just like, the VA isn't looking after them, and they were out, and there's no place to go.
Mm-hmm.
Is this correct, or is this just a myth?
No, it's true that about 13% across the country of homeless individuals are veterans. Some of this, it's not just Vietnam veterans, which I think would be the stereotype. In fact, my book opens up with me working with a World War II veteran. There's times when I've worked with Korean War veterans. And right now, you know, as we speak, there's people from Iraq and Afghanistan that end up coming home not getting, for various reasons, not getting the support that they need. Sometimes the things are just not diagnosed properly. Sometimes the person doesn't trust the veterans, you know, the VA for the help.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people have had very negative experience while they're in the field of battle, and they feel betrayed by their country. And so the option of, you know, getting help, even if it's free care through Veteran Affairs, is something that's off the table for them. So, you know, one of the big issues you come across in working with people who are homeless, whether it's veterans from actual wars, whether it's children coming out of foster care, whether it's adults that have had some traumatic accident that occurred or a mental illness or what have you, is this real issue of trust. It's not as easy as just saying, well, why don't you go over here or there and get the help? A lot of people feel mistreated. They feel betrayed. They feel like they shouldn't be in the situation they're in to begin with. So it's a process to build a relationship with a person, for them to get to know you, to engage well, for them to see that you respect their autonomy, their sense of freedom, which often is the one strong thing they can hold on to in the midst of all the tragedy they've suffered, and to begin to language with them, understand their world, and present ideas and options in a way that can really resonate, so the person can begin to say, okay, this is really is a possibility, and there really is some hope. I can envision a different, you know, kind of future or way.
I'm amazed that, you know, you said 13% of the homelessness are in the, with vets, and that's sad. That is really sad. So I'm thinking here in Austin, we have many of the popular corners. All four corners are, you know, there's somebody that's homeless with a sign asking for money or food or work, or sometimes they're just even up front and asking for money for beer or something. So it just always amazes me that they're there, and yet, you know, on the other hand, I know that there are places like the Salvation Army, and here in Austin we have Caritas that provide services for the homeless. So I'm wondering why they're still there on the corner. Is it a choice, or is it really that I am being naive and Caritas and Salvation Army and, so you know, all these other places do not really provide the services for them?
Yeah, well, it's a real mix of things, actually. And I think it's a bit of a myth to say, you know, people are out there by choice and this is the lifestyle that they have chosen and therefore live. What I find, and I give these examples, I think, pretty regularly throughout the book, that as you get to know people and as you appreciate their world and how they're living and can connect with them in a way that's meaningful, so that when you present options, all of a sudden they're now willing to consider things like getting housed and being attached to a support service. A lot of it has to do with dignity. I mean, it's one thing to have a number of places that are offering services, but it's another thing as to whether the person feels like when they go there that people are really understanding their situation. It's almost like the difference between a fast food approach to kind of a problem. You know, this is the menu, you know, choose, make the right choices and move forward. Or I really want to hear what your situation is, you know, what you've been through. Oh, and based on what you're telling me, you know, I hear where you're at. You might be interested in this route or that option. And I think that's kind of the problem. The system is set up more in kind of a fast food way where people are expected to make quick choices. And a lot of things, they're not ready to choose. many people have tried some of the old ways and methods of getting out of homelessness before. They've tried various programs. They've gone in and out of houses that says, you know, you have to be sober and in recovery and this kind of thing. And they've constantly relapsed, and so they get kicked out, and then they end up back on the streets again. Some of the folks I've worked with really don't have, at least in the beginning, the ability to enter a house that has that set of rules and to be able to follow those rules successfully. You know, their addictions are on such a level that they haven't really learned to manage it. They're not at a place in their recovery, if you were to think in terms of stages of change, where you have to be to get to a real action phase and begin an active recovery process with all the supports there that's needed to maintain one, you know, away from addiction. A lot of these folks aren't at that place as of yet. So the whole really basis of pre-treatment, which is what I talk about, a whole pre-treatment approach to helping people, is to get where they're at and to build from there. And so I work off of these basic models, whether it's the change model, and if someone's in a pre-contemplative stage, and you got to start there, and you got to start with the education and the offering of things that make sense in terms of, you know, the place where the person's at. If they initially don't want to engage with you, then you're thinking in terms of stages of engagement, and the first step is just to get an initial conversation going with the person. If you're listening to a person's story, the first step in terms of languaging is to understand their words, their ideas, their values, and to begin appealing to those words, ideas, and values and connect that to the various programs and services that are available so the person can really consider it rather than feel like an authority is just telling them to do it. And then a lot of it is working with the services. So, you know, like Salvation Army, a lot of that is based on you have to have a certain religious affiliation, in a sense, to do good work with the Salvation Army, or at least a religious connection, because that's kind of what they're preaching through there. There's a place called Rescue Mission out where I work, and it's the same thing. They'll work with everybody, but part of what they say and do is very God-centered, and so you're going to hear a lot of that, and there's a number of folks that are out there. That's not where they're at, so it's hard for them to listen to that and connect to that. And these places, again, tend to be very rule-oriented, so a lot of the folks that we're working with that are long-term homeless are really used to doing their own thing, going by their own rules. So it's a process of transition and adaptation to even connect them to a program. And it's a lot of work, but it can be done. I've seen, you know, many, many people turn around.
Oh, God, there's hope. So, Jay, do you have a figure of actually how many homeless people there are in the United States? Has anybody been able to at least come up with something close?
Yeah, there's various estimates. They have, through HUD, a one-day count that they do, and it's called a point-in-time count. They do it every year. It's at the end of January when it's done, and they say on any given night, there's over 640,000 homeless people. Out of that, about 63%, or over 60% anyways, are individuals.
Wow.
But keep in mind, that's a one-day count.
Yeah.
There's a lot of short-term homelessness. So there's a lot of people coming in and out due to economic issues, which is the biggest factor for people who are just homeless for a week or a month. And when you include those folks, if you were to count the people coming in and out of homelessness over an entire year, we're talking about anywhere from 2 to 3.5 million people who are homeless annually. So there's a lot of people that are out there. Out of the individuals that are homeless, about a third of them are, you know, at any given point in time, are among the long-term homeless and are really vulnerable and at risk.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. We're speaking today with Jay Beebe, author of Homeless Narratives and Pretreatment Pathways, From Words to Housing. As you've heard so far, homelessness is very prevalent in our society, and we have a long way to go before we can see less people out in the streets. I invite you to continue to listen as we delve more into the issue at hand. And by the way, Jay's website is jslevy.com, and that is jayslevy.com. When you're talking about long term, how long is this term?
Well, there's different ways to look at that, but the HUD definition, kind of the guiding federal guidelines on it, is people who have been homeless either for 12 consecutive months or more.
Oh, okay.
And have some sort of disability in addition. They call it the chronic homeless population. Or people who have been episodically homeless, and that would be four or more times in 3 years.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about the health issues and concerns and deaths that occur because, of lack of health care.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine those figures are really high, too.
They're very high. There's very high mortality rates, which I don't have right in front of me, but I can tell you that long-term homeless folks, on average, are dying in their 40s and 50s. People who particularly who are living unsheltered have been out there for 6 months or more. And there's a whole vulnerability scale that's been set up by Healthcare for the Homeless, which is a national organization. Dr. Jim O'Connell, who's the head of the Boston affiliation, and Dr. Wang together have put out what's called a vulnerability index, and it's a way of determining who's at risk of death and getting a sense on, because of the lack of resources, who we really need to prioritize first to get in and get housed and hopefully make a pathway toward treatment and medical services. And so they've been able to say that if someone within a 3 month period have had 3 visits to emergency rooms, then they're at high risk of death. If someone has a triple diagnosis, meaning medical issues, substance abuse issues, and mental health issues, and that's untreated, they're at high risk of death. If someone's over 60 years old, staying outside, they're at high risk of death. And if someone has a history of frostbite or other major medical issues, such as liver disease, heart issues, cardiac issues, they're at high risk. So, this is what we come across when we do outreach and get to know people.
Well, not only those things that you're talking about, but I'm also thinking that in most cases, homeless people do not get a balanced diet. They eat whatever they can, and sometimes it's, stuff that people have thrown out. And, of course, this is probably causes a lot of health issues also.
Yeah, if you think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense that people that have all these chronic medical issues are living the way they do. 46% of the people that are just homeless clients, they've done research on this, have chronic medical issues, whether they're in shelter or out of shelter. It's higher with the unsheltered population, but that includes like diabetes, hepatitis, high blood pressure, things like that. They're not good at being able to regulate diet. They're not necessarily living in very sanitary or safe places. So, the good news in all of this, and it can be very depressing to listen to is there's been a real movement across the country, and in particular in Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., New York City, and some other areas, I believe also Seattle, towards some housing first programming. And that's been a real change in how we go about doing the work. And I've been involved in designing some housing first programming. And that's another thing that I allude to and talk about in the book as well.
So as it is right now, who is paying for the health care or for the housing or for any other services that that you are involved with? Who is actually paying for these people to get these services?
Well, some of it is through, you know, standard health insurance. Some of it is through state programming, federal funds. So it really depends, you know, what particular service and, you know, where the funds are coming from. So, and, you know, there's some also, you know, the faith community chips in and does some help with this as well. I think that's important to keep in mind. But for the most part, it's government funds that go toward there. I mean, it is, you know, depending on the particular program, you know, there was HPRP stimulus money that came down recently through the Obama administration. A lot of that was prevention dollars that went toward trying to stem the tide of short-term homelessness. There's the program that I work with, which is the PATH program. Across the country, there's this kind of programming, which is outreach workers that are trying to connect people to housing. And in our case, it's 15 clinicians that we have that cover central Massachusetts and western Massachusetts that I supervise. Mm-hmm. And we connect with people in the shelters, on the streets, wherever they may be, and help transition them to housing and also create pathways toward treatment.
And I would imagine it's never enough funding, is it?
Well, we could use another set of workers in addition to the ones that we have.
Of course, of course. And you know, you're talking about your area, and then when we talk about the whole United States, it gets dwindled down.
It does, and every state has a different level of commitment to this. In some states, there's very few services, including, you know, even access to meals and things like that, and other states are more resource-rich, so a lot of it depends on the commitment and the value people feel like there is in providing the service. There's a great article entitled Million Dollar Murray by Malcolm Gladwell. And what it's about is what's the cost if you don't address these issues? What's the cost in terms of financially? And Million Dollar Murray is an example of a guy living in Reno, Nevada, who over a 10-year period, you know, the cost of really not helping him, just working with kind of acute services, getting him in and out of detoxes and emergency rooms and that kind of thing, his medical bills added up to $1 million.
Oh, my.
And what we found is if we just pair support services with affordable housing for about $15,000 a person, we could be serving that person effectively. So there's ways to do that and to target the long-term homeless because, you know, we're paying one way or another. You know, we're paying in terms of our standard of living. We're paying in terms of the kind of community we are if we're going to allow this to happen in terms of the ethical issues. And then we're paying in terms of just the acute service dollars and, you know, it's police response. It's the response of keeping people in shelter, that costs money. It's the response of inpatient services. So, you know, there's both, I think, moral reasons and financial reasons to try and do better.
Mm-hmm. Your book, Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways, the subtitle is From Words to Housing. And to me, that means action. So what you're advocating is like, okay, enough talking. Let's get these people into housing.
Yeah, there's a double meaning to it. That's one level of the meaning. The other level is when you're doing outreach and you're meeting people for the first time and getting to know someone, our main tool is our words.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like things really start there.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to find a way to, in understanding the person's world, what that means is understanding their words, their ideas, their values, and building a bridge from that to why it might make sense to consider, you know, seeing a doctor or working with a psychiatrist. If you start with the language of, you know, I can hook you up with a psychiatrist, you know, it looks like you have some mental health issues, the person doesn't feel connected to that. And so, you know, in our world, our clinical world, you know, mental health might mean one thing to us, like we're trying to help. In their world, they think we're just saying, you know, you're crazy.
Yeah.
And so you have to deal with those kinds of realities and really talk the language of the person. They're aware, you know, most people you meet are aware that they have certain types of issues, but they connect to it in a very different way through a very different language. And so you need to learn to be able to talk to them in that way. And it might be that the person feels that they go through a lot of stress every day and they can't handle the stress very well, but would never call it mental illness or a mental health issue.
So you, as a person that works with the homeless people, I'm hearing a lot of passion for these people and, you know, your internal need to really help them.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think it's something that I felt from a very early age. I remember living in Brooklyn, and this was in the 80s, and really noticing that there was a lot more people around without homes than I've ever seen before. And I'd bump into them in my daily travels, whether it was on the subway or literally almost on the porch of where I lived. And every day you would ask yourself a question, you know, what can I do about this? Should I give money? Is that going to help? And I was right at that age of first connecting into social work school and realized that this was an area I could go into and then hopefully make a difference.
And obviously you have made a difference.
Well, thanks. I feel that way, in both in writing the book and also some of the new Housing First programs that have come about now. This whole pre-treatment method goes hand in hand with Housing First work, which is you don't have to, you know, a lot of the way the system has been set up through the years, it's almost like we're asking people who are long-term homeless to denounce some of their values or who they are to accept the services that they need. You know, if you say, well, we can offer you a mental health service, but first you have to agree that you have a mental illness, you know, there's a real block there. And that's the way the standard delivery of care often is. You know, if you go to a mental health clinic, they want to know, well, why are you coming? You know, what's your issue?
Yeah, right.
A lot of folks we meet, they're not ready to state that. Same thing with addiction. They may not be ready to state that. So we have to start where the client's at. And Housing First is all about putting the housing at the front.
Mm-hmm.
And just in a realistic way, going over with the person what their commitment can be toward, let's say, paying rent if it's affordable, taking care of the property, getting along with neighbors, you know, really make it just real world challenges for them. And then you can kind of look at what the barriers are, but you do that in a way where you're joined with the person and saying, I want this to really work for you, and I have this housing that I'm directly connected to that we can take a walk over to right now and you can see it. So it's very real, you know, the housing's connected directly to the outreach teams. And as we get the person into the housing, we make a commitment to continue to work with the person and to continue to kind of problem solve with them if they are having difficulties, maybe paying rent or getting along with a neighbor or whatever it is, and slowly begin to connect them to all of the services they may need, including treatment.
Well, I can certainly see that it's one step at a time. And the first thing is, from what I'm hearing you saying, is for you as a facilitator to build that trust and somebody that they can actually listen to and trust that you do have some information for them and that you are on their side.
Yes, it's a lot of joining to show that you're on the person's side.
Mm-hmm.
It's building the trust and it's respecting their autonomy. And they need to know you're not there simply to tell them what to do, but to actually kind of go on a journey with them to figure out what works and what doesn't work. And if you take it from that standpoint and the person really believes that you're there to help, not to just tell them what your agenda is, like you have some other agenda. If your agenda is really about them and them being successful in their housing and having a better quality of life, then all of a sudden new pathways, new avenues open up that the person can kind of go down and get the help that they need. And that's why part of the title of the book is Pre-Treatment Pathways.
Mm-hmm.
It's understanding the person's story and then finding the pre-treatment pathway that can work for them.
Wow. It's been a great interview. I'm just sitting here and sort of, you know, going within myself and seeing what I can do as part of society to help. Jay, what is your website address?
Oh, thanks for asking. I would have forgotten. it's www.jayslevy.com.
Okay, that's J-A-Y-S as in Sam, L-E-V as in Victor, Y.com. There you go, listeners. Now, hasn't that been an interesting conversation we've had with Jay? I know I've learned a lot, and as I said a few minutes ago, that I'm just really having to go within and do some more soul searching on the homelessness that I often see when I'm driving down the street, and you know, all four corners of all popular corners are filled with these people asking for help and making an attitude change. And so, Jay, I really, really appreciate you coming onto this program and talking to us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great to be here, wherever here may be.
And listeners, there again, we were speaking with Jay Levy. He is the author of Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways from Words to Housing. Thank you very much for listening. This is Irene Watson for Inside Scoop Live. Bye for now.